Oh, okay. Another exciting morning. I was up a little. Well, I've had to be going to bed earlier because I'm sorry, I'm crashing. I'm crashing earlier because of my schedule. It's a little inhumane because that means I have I've pushed forward the schedule, and can I be honest, it's largely a schedule that Lisa put together, and I'm grateful for it. Let me tell you, Lisa's really good at schedules and things that have to be done, habits. Now she's gotten older, she isn't quite as strident as she was when the kids were young. Aren't what needed to be done. She, you know, when we're younger, we are mostly driven by the expectations that were put on us by our parents. And, for like housekeeping and lawn maintenance, stuff like that, things that really mattered a lot. I seem to recall that as a kid in California, an inordinate amount of time was usually spent babying your motor vehicle. And although and that was kind of like, well, it was this guy pulled over to let me pass. He's awfully nice. Knowing that it takes him an hour to churn up to speed. Anyway, so just everything that needed to be done, and cars were a status symbol at the time, and the status was a big thing. And last time I went back to California to go see family, which was at my grandmother's funeral, it was seen again that it was still kind of a thing to have nice cars and to. And when they say take care of the cars, it means don't let it get dirty, do a wax job on it, stuff like that. And that was what was done. I apologize for my lack of notes, as always here. Because, I think Lisa's getting a little down, the appellation from I guess it's more from the brethren than scripture of enduring to the end, really is that. It is an endurance. What do you have to do? What are the expectations, As we get older, both we start to realize that a lot of the stuff that we thought was so darned important might not actually be as important as we thought. Although some things that we let slip can be a bad thing too, It's like, oh, this is, you don't want to keep a house filthy to the point to where you're encouraging vermin and disease. And yeah, so anyway, I was awake this morning talking to Heavenly Father about various things and about what I could be about during this time. I'm kind of tricky because I'm going past this guy and you get the impression he might be dozing off. I understand that. That's one of my problems too, and I really need to pull over and just take a nap or something for a few minutes, just so I'm not in that case where I'm nodding off. Oh, anyway, I was talking to Heavenly Father about some things that I could do, improvements I could make, and that's really what what it's about to a large extent is doing what needs to be done. But also on the order of development, we have to a large extent lowered the societal standards or dropped them away completely. The kind of anything goes attitude. I can't say much. I'm kind of libertarian, so I'm kind of an anything, not that anything goes, but that you can choose what you value. It's not something that has to be codified in law or society and how society looks at things and says, you're socially unacceptable because of this and this and this. And I've become somewhat pragmatic over, not that I wasn't when I was young, but I've become even more pragmatic over time. For just saying, you know, you want certain things to go a certain way. You want what we call respectability. You have to do things to get respectability. Although I can say that they're making some interesting inroads in forced respectability. You know, anti-discrimination laws substitute for respectability, social norms. And so lots of groups, even those who are quite deviant, all they have to do is get themselves added to anti-discrimination laws, and all of a sudden you have to treat them with some level of respect, which I don't know. This is, I'm sorry, you can't dictate to individuals how they feel and how they're really going to treat you. People find ways around anti-discrimination rules. When it comes to work, for instance, they go, well, you can't deny me work and you can't do that. Well, I don't have to hire you just because you are a party to an anti-discrimination law. I can't overtly discriminate against you, you know, but I can just, you know, it becomes very important to vet people before you hire them. If there's a certain skill set that you really want, anyway, so I'm sorry, I'm circling back, and I want people to know that it's something of notes. The fact that I don't have notes here and that I'm being kind of spontaneous, and under normal circumstances, of course, I'm going off of a bit of an outline. I am an outline nut. I outline most things in life. That's my organizational style. Some people use Kanban board raceways. That's pretty good for a workflow. And I kind of shoehorn things like that into an outline for me. And often the outlines get really big, and then you have to refactor the outline to make it to make it so it's more useful with immediacy, what you immediately need to do. I use it as a store of knowledge too, and that means that you almost have to keep two or three outlines going, whether together or separately, to track things. Anyway, I'm trying to circle around to development, because that was what I was thinking about this morning when I was in the wee hours, when I was sitting there and I was thinking about myself and my kids and where they're going and what their interests seem to be. This is certainly a time where an individual's interests can reign supreme. And there's more interesting ways to get away with it. I think of like social media influencers and how most of us who are older and lived in a world where that didn't really work. That was mostly the realm of salespeople. You know, they were social influencers. Their whole job was to wine and dine you to sell you something. The better salesmen sold bigger things. But yeah. Lately, there's been a change. I gotta tell you, a whole lot of people who were kind of about sales were into got into either real estate or insurance, because those were quite lucrative. Insurance is interesting in that there are now different avenues. I don't think they've gotten creative enough about insurance. You're still typically tied to most insurance companies still tie you to some kind of an agent. In my case, the person I have as an agent is some random person that just happened to pick up my house insurance and my car insurance, because I tend to bundle them, you know, to save money. It's one of the cheapest things I could get. And the lady that is ostensibly my agent, and they try to make sure that she's actually engaged a little bit, although she doesn't have to be. I don't ask her questions particularly. She just kind of gets my business as a windfall, and the fact that it contributes to her income as long as I keep that policy is really great for her, because she put forth no effort to get me. She puts forth no effort to keep me, particularly, you know. And so, ta-da, it's pretty easy work for her. Anyway, and real estate people, almost anybody can just drop into real estate. There is a little bit of training that your state requires. There's a little bit of, you know, there's forms to be filled out, things like that. And to be put through the underwriter. If you get a good insurance, if you get a good real estate agent, their primary role is to help you through the Byzantine world of this. I don't know if it ever got particularly codified, but it runs that way, that their usual fee is 6% of the sale. Which means that they much more prefer to sell big houses. And wow. Anyway. And this is where comes the social media influencer, is really those kind of people. How little effort can I put into what I need to do in order to maximize profits? And you see that in social media. Not that I want to tell you, but you know, that's something that was really kind of a niche thing, and now it's become a huge thing. A lot of us get a lot of our information through the internet, through social media influencers. They kind of, in some strange way, act as information brokers, people who trust them. I said, can I tell you what? Your school teacher was probably was an early social media influencer, especially for children. and especially for college students. You know, the fact that college professors are have become so influential in so many ways. A lot of the I don't like calling it the LGBT community. It's not a community. I don't like that they've kind of subverted the rainbow, but they did it. There it is. It says, you know, you guys are going to pay for that. That's, as far as I'm aware of, that's taking God's name in vain. That was a symbol that God put up to say that he wouldn't destroy man by flood ever again. And it's been subverted, and now it's being used by people who say, hey, we can do whatever we want, and you need to treat us good, and march in our pride parades to make us feel validated. And you go, well, this is, do what you feel is right. So I tend to call that the Rainbow Coalition. And I know it's probably being used by another group, I don't care, because I think that's far more better. It is a political coalition of really disparate groups. I'm sorry, gays and lesbians have almost nothing in common with transgenders. They're totally at cross purposes, and what they're after is only thinly put together. Anyway, for the Rainbow Coalition was really kind of founded on college campuses. You know, it's young, it's hip, and as we've gotten younger and younger professors who are wanting to attract students, these are things that are currently quite attractive to the college age set, is exploring sexuality. When people, I'm sorry, you know, people talk about college in about 20 different ways. And one of the big ways is that college is where you're supposed to find yourself. This is your first opportunity to get away from your parents. And let me tell you, parents are soundly hated these days. Culturally, told by society that parents are bad people, that parents forced a patriarchy down your throat, things like that, told you to behave this way and that way. And the wholesale rebellion against that is really a rebellion against parents. And I was never a person to rebel against my parents. And you go, well, you were weird. And you go, I don't care if I was weird. It means that I have a good relationship by and large with my parents. I've had to kind of, you know, you always want some distance from your parents. You really want to do what you want to do without having a constant stream of people telling you what that is. And so I tried to cultivate that a little bit more with my kids. I think Shayna, our oldest, got kind of a pretty heavy dose of people looking over her shoulder and saying, oh, you should have done this, or oh, you should have done that, you know, on almost kind of a play-by-play basis, if you want to give it a sports analogy. And you really do have to pull back from that and say, you know, do that. You know, if my oldest daughter is resentful, and to a large degree, I think it led to a lot of the things that she chose to do, and the fact that she took the rebellion revolution as far as she did, comes from the fact, you know, all parents are doing this for the first time, and they won't do it again, by and large, or shouldn't do it again. That our everybody's development path needs to have this this period where you're in charge. You know, in that it looks like it requires rebellion. I don't think that that's necessary. I think people that kind of got stuck into the culture in the past to say, you know, oh, you need to, you know, after high school, all these little things. I think it's interesting what people consider to be social constructs. The way we do phases in life, I think, is a deep social construct that you don't particularly need to honor. Now things that are deeper, I think, like this whole thing about gender, that's actually a cooked up marketing term. If you're going to say, well, I'm not a man, I'm really a woman, and you go, I'm sorry, you've now gone into this whole social construct garbage, and you say that that's a social construct, you go, no, I'm pretty sure it's biological. You're not going to be a man. You know, a woman cannot become a man. You can't all of a sudden become a person that creates sperm. It's just and everybody says, oh, science will figure out how we can do that. And you go, guy, I hope not. What's the point? Right now, we kind of have something of a balance, and it's kind of natural that we're going to have pretty much as many men as we have women. We're going to have pretty much as I don't know why we're getting larger and larger and larger groups of people who either cannot or will not or have been acculturized to refusing to couple. You know, there was some really good things. Over time, we have developed some pretty good structures that in the last, oh, I don't know, it's really accelerated in the last 10 years or so. But those didn't just pop out of nowhere. They were always kind of there in the background, but always very fringe. And the fact that they're not fringe anymore is problematic. And the fact that when we see these increases, some social scientists say, well, that was just because so many people were forced into the closet. And you go, I don't, you know, I said, I'm sorry. I said, I'm pretty sure that a larger group is not people that were forced in the closet. It's people who find it trendy to do these things and to do life-altering surgeries, for instance. After being, I the only term that really seems to fit is groomed to do this for some weird political agenda is, I find it kind of sick, but people are doing it. My whole thing is, guys, this is, look at the end from the beginning. If you're going to go down this road, you're going to be doing stuff to actually alter yourself, to do something else. Think of the ultimate ramifications to you. Other people don't need to be accepting of you. Other people do not need to fawn over you. They all say, you know, that people who fawn on them are good, and people who don't fawn all over them are evil and bad. And you go, you know what? I said, if you have an employer who's not going to fawn over your whatever, your choices in sexual orientation or things like that, says, you want them to, by law, be obligated to treat you fantastically. And to trip over themselves, to walk on broken glass, walk on eggshells is the term we used to use. Walk on eggshells around you. And, you know, if I want to have this profession or that profession, this job or that job, you don't need, you know, you have to let me do that. And it's like, wow, this is new that we have to do things like that. And you go, okay, The freedom seems, you know, you seem to be enjoying freedom, but you want to hamstring everybody else around you. And you go, what happened to their freedom? And so, yeah, when people say that this is a really narcissistic way of looking, it says they really have a point, because that's really troublesome. From the standpoint of, you know, I'm not treating other people the way I want to be treated. You know, if you just want to have your own sexual kink, or if you want to, you know, I you try not to downplay how deeply everyone feels about this, but you also go, you guys are using all the depth of interest that, frankly, we typically see in crazy mixed up teenagers. And, you know, I don't care what age you are particularly, you know, when I would look at kids and at, you would give, you know, you would measure things by their chronological age, their developmental age, their maturational age, based on established milestones. Have they reached this? Are they able to skip? You know, kids start skipping at, I forget what time it was. Kids can usually skip somewhere in their three-year-old range. If we don't see them being able to skip at 3 years old, we start taking a look at them and saying, you know, what's the problem? And we might start delving into developmental things. A lot of things can affect development. Anyway, so you can always look at it that way and you go, wow, these people who are wanting to change their genders because they feel like they don't fit into some kind of weird gender norm. Right now, I'm sorry to say, womanhood has become really highly sexualized and really highly, I mean, you have to look a certain way. You have to have certain attitudes, all these things. And it's become such a straitjacket that it's not surprising that a lot of women go, well, I want to be a man now, because men don't have these so many rules about them, and you don't have to meet so many body standards, you know, a body and a look standard of just looking amazing. You know, everybody has to be kind of a Hollywood movie starlet. The poor thing about the old starlets in the old days is that they used to be unique. You know, you would get a job in Hollywood if you were particularly attractive looking. And you can say, oh, that's just patriarchy in men. You go, well, I'm sorry, the biggest judges of women and how they do it are other women. You know, fashion is largely run by women these days. It was only run by men in the past because it was a business, and business was the realm of men. That's not so much true anymore. Women can are just as likely to be in business now as men are. And let me tell you, it's true. It says, if you want a social media influencer that works well, if you want somebody to get popular, it's really important that, number one, they're female. Number two, that they're good looking. Number three, that they're able to rattle it off pretty well. I find it interesting, and I know other people see this too, about cuts, how many cuts you have in a recording that you make. And the more cuts that have to be done because you're not doing it quite right, every girl has kind of been sensitized to want to be kind of an actress. And so, and I'm sorry, I will use the gender term because it works better in this case. They all they all want to have that kind of attention. And you go, see, and that becomes the problem. When I say all, that's wrong. Some of them don't. And the ones that don't tend to think of themselves more, I wish I was a boy so I wouldn't be held to such weird standards of trying to get ahead. And that's how you ultimately win the day, is having the best makeup regimen, being able to, you know, be sexually attractive on a couple of levels, not just to men, but I'm sorry, social media really is kind of a woman's blood sport. And so yeah, you're constantly in competition with other women, and women who are more appealing to look at tend to win in those competitions. And it's tough, and I understand. But anyway, guy, I need to come back, because I started talking about development, and that's what this was really about. The fact that it's gone off in this direction just makes me crazy. I should probably just finish off this particular line of talk and go on while I have time here and try to actually focus on development itself, as opposed to manifestations of things. And this will probably, you know, because I think I'm wanting one of these to send one of these recordings to be my intro for teaching. When those guys say, we really want to get a sense of you as a teacher or as an instructor, you know, as somebody who can do this. And it really is, to a certain degree, you have to look at yourself as kind of a social media influencer. And so I'm going to certainly bring that up too, so that they go, oh yeah, he's got it, he understands it. And you go, to a certain extent, you kind of have to do that, because you really have to sell yourself. And often sell whatever information you're trying to provide. It really is kind of a sales job. And to the point to where you understand that, and you go, it's okay, I'm going to do what it takes to sell this. And, of course, one of the bigger problems is once you get into sales, you start seeing what attracts people. And you'll start peddling that, because, I'm sorry, it's an easier sell. Kind of like a big, beautiful house as opposed to a hovel. It's harder to sell hovels, even though they're cheaper, because, you know, it's a hard product to push. People don't want to live in a hovel particularly. And they certainly don't need somebody talking them into it. They usually fall into the hovel. You know, it's much easier to do a house that's got a fresh coat of paint, that's got, you know, that's dolled up, kind of like a social media influencer. The more dolled up they are, the better off they tend to be. Now, I don't tend to spend a lot of time in those kinds of realms. I tend to go more toward the information ones. There's one called Althist. No, what if Althist? I'm trying to think how he did it. He originally started out doing alternative history, but then it got far more interesting, and maybe it was just something that he found. Yeah, I'm sorry. Don't come crawling up my butt, man. I got to get around this fella, and then you can have all the butt thing you want. Driving is such a interesting thing. I'm sure this guy's cursing me out for getting in front of him. But I didn't want to wait for – he wasn't coming up fast enough to get around me before I had to get out of this lane for another reason. Okay. So, yeah, the whole idea of social media and what – and the fact that I think college professors are in kind of a bit of a I don't know if it's really a competition, but for butts and seats, for people to come and listen to them, and if they say something that's very attractive to other groups, to students, that's good, you know. But all of a sudden starts being this weird psychological loop that you put people into, you know. I talked about gender issues because that was enticing to some people. So once I get them in there, we start talking about it. People feel validated by the fact that we're talking about it in a quote respectable setting. You know, college has always been considered a respectable setting and still is. Says, however, you know, as time passes, as the stuff continues to happen, it's losing some of its inherent respectability. Now, to some extent, it doesn't care. And a lot of things are just like, well, we talk about things that people don't, you know, that we're studying. And I think people come into college to, you know, and get maybe a PhD in one of these softer sciences, you know, they call them the studies programs now, relatively less rigorous study course. It's not as difficult to get a PhD in it, depending on where you get it from. When I was thinking about getting a PhD, it was going to be in something soft and squidgy, and it was in wisdom studies, which is like, yeah, it's a study, and is it about, you know? When I look at some of the courses, it's like, oh no, this is all about deviant sexuality, which I'm not into, and I'm not interested in hawking that. And I'm sorry, I do have an understanding that as a college professor, you're supposed to be into it to the point to where you lead the sense of orthodoxy in whatever field you're in. And of course I'm horrible from the whole standpoint of I don't want an expensive, difficult PhD. I don't see the point. You know, if I need a PhD, it's not gonna be in something that's gonna be that rough. The whole understanding that you have to be somewhat an attractive person to what you're gonna be teaching. So this might be circling around to that. It always used to be good because if somebody had really done something for a while and really became quite either successful or something enough to teach it, that this person usually had the kind of attributes that were attractive, or that students would go, hey, that person's a lot like me. And they, you know, and you would become their role model. And that's really a big thing, I think, in this is, do you present as a role model to these people? And I'm an interesting choice for any particular field of endeavor because I've switched around a bit, and so I don't just do one thing. To be honest, for a person like me, information technology will suck you in with the money possible. I'm a smart guy. I can do several things. And information technology just happens to be one of them on some level. But I just don't have the right temperament for it. You know, I'm a little bit hot-headed, and you really want kind of cool heads, cool hands, who don't mind doing a lot of quasi-repetitive work until you have a chance to automate it, which means that they're going to need less and less of these kinds of people as things get more and more automated. I was just reading an article about how many servers in a data center get taken care of by one tech. And it, back in the old days, you might have one or two people to each major piece of equipment. You know, a supercomputer would actually have maybe two or three people, a team who maintained it and took care of all of the work that needs to be done around it. Now, it really ends up being like when I was at the college taking care of their computer center. I think we probably had about 50 computers. And there was a group we probably had more like 100. But there was a group of 6 people who took care of the whole thing, you know, whether it was Linux or Windows and the backup person and everything else. And everything was pushing toward getting a newer and better solution so that it was more self-serve. And that fewer people could take care of things. Now you still needed the people who kind of handled the applications anyway. But now at most data centers, what people say is we try to have one tech for every 150 computers. And that number is always striving to go up. That you have monitoring and sensors sufficient to be able to maintain that many computers, and you're kept reasonably busy just taking care of what alarms come up each day for what needs to be taken care of. If you're a back end guy, if you're a front end guy, you know, says, I think we may have, to a certain extent, we have raised user consciousness, or we have made computers easy enough for users to solve a lot of problems. And I was always a guy that empowered users and said, you just go ahead and you just use it, you experiment, you try something. And if it goes wonky, then I'm there to help you to not just to help you, but to just take over and fix it so that it works again. And that was when I was back in more of the desktop sort of motif, office group, work group level stuff before I went to the back end. And to be honest, I'm not really all that hip about the back end. I did better, I think, personality wise on the front end, although there's plenty of frustrations there as well. Anyway, so that's something that needs to be talked about, is the difference between the front end and the back end and what all has to happen there and which way you prefer to go. Once you go one way or the other, you know, there isn't really a lot of bouncing back and forth. Why I'm glad I'm kind of getting into teaching is, so it says, you know, do we want to help people to do technical support, or do we want to help people do back end stuff? And you go, those are two different animals, and it behaves differently. People don't like having a lot of monitoring on them, so you don't tend to monitor desktops quite the same way as you monitor the back end stuff, which is heavily monitored. anyway, so, but I need to be thinking along those lines too in preparation for further interviews about how this goes. So many outfits are wanting technical support. You can do a lot of online technical support, but can I be honest? It's mostly gone to other countries. You're not so likely to get that kind of a job just doing telephone or computer desktop support, because that can be done from anywhere, and that's really gone to other countries. Although some people definitely kill themselves trying to make sure that they have different accents. A lot of people are very unhappy with the Indianization of technical support that you're going to most likely be hearing from an Indian voice, and sometimes they can't pull off kind of a British-ish or higher Indian English accent. So sometimes it's hard to understand what they're saying. They've outsourced so much of development and back-end technical support to these places because, you know, when you're doing it as part of a business, you have to be much more tolerant of, you know, your customers, by and large, end up being more tolerant of different voices because you absolutely have to have that information and, you know, you just got to deal with it. And however they choose to do it and the way they look at it. Kind of a stinted, scripted service model. It says, and you got to be, I guess you got to be ready for that. It says, this is kind of the way it's going, and this is the standard. They might like you because of your voice. If you can't explain yourself very well, and I'm not saying I'm God's gift to it. That's what a lot of technical support places are looking for, but they usually just have to take what they can get, especially if you have a particular skill set that's hard to fill. Anyway, which is what we're trying to get done here, is like, what are we trying to train you toward? What are we trying to get? Where are we trying to put you? So that it's a good match for you. Anyway, so I didn't get around talking about development. I need to, so I'm going to go ahead and stop this one, and I'm not going to put the priestly imprint on it because I don't think I was talking about something particularly priestly. Although I have to say, the Lord Himself doesn't confine himself to strictly religious topics. He's all over the place because he's about development. He's wanting you to get somewhere. He's wanting you to become a certain kind of person. This isn't in doing that, you know, he ranges all over the place. But I'll leave it at that. This has been Cohen Meander. I'm Jason Nemer. Have a great day.